Welcome, this is Mark Steiner.
And this is Leah Gilmore.
And we are about to have a conversation with Leah and our guests on music, women in America, and the blues, and the history of our music. This is African-American Music Appreciation Month.
Yes, it is.
One of our shows around that issue. But before we get there, we'll play a little bit more of Odetta in a second. As we come back to this, I'm going to let you know what happened today in our history, and then we'll leap into this conversation.
It's a very special day.
A lot happened. In 1862, Abraham Lincoln outlined his Emancipation Proclamation, which outlawed slavery in the South and in the territories of the United States. Not in the North, let's remember, and not in the Union states. This is also the day that we near the end of the Spanish Civil War, when the fascists took over, and they began to kind of kill off all the freedom fighters of Spain. This is also the day that the United States Supreme Court struck down a provision in Maryland's Constitution that required state office holders to profess a belief in God. That happened in 1961. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was approved after an 83-day filibuster in the U.S. Senate. Another Southerner pushed that through. His name was Lyndon Baines Johnson, who had an awakening during the Civil Rights Movement, changing of mind and
that
heart.
That
many people don't know about.
Right.
On this day, 45 years ago, I was in a certain place. On this day, 45 years ago, I was on a march in Washington, D.C. It was a poor people's march. It was an interracial union of African-American, white, Mexican, Puerto Rican, Native American poor people marching for economic rights. One of the last things that Martin Luther King did before he was assassinated was say, we have to have this poor people's campaign. It has to be multiracial. We have to fight for economic rights and not just civil rights.
And many people think that's why he was assassinated.
So on this day that happened. And this day was important because that was June 19th, 1968 when that occurred. That was Juneteenth.
Oh, right.
And today is Juneteenth.
Today is Juneteenth.
Juneteenth being the day.
The oldest known celebration commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. And Juneteenth is really special because most folks don't really know about it. But in the African-American community now and it's spreading in a wider community, it's become a real celebration and it's become officially celebrated now in 42 of our 50 states.
Right.
So that's a very cool thing.
It was a day that, I forget the general's name, I'm blocking on the general's
name. General Gordon Granger.
Yes, who landed in Galveston, Texas, to say to Texas, the Civil War was over. That's the day when the slaves in Texas knew they were free, were the last black folks in America to know that they were free.
2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the war.
Juneteenth. So let's cue up that Odetta so people can really hear this Odetta piece we didn't hear before. And hear that as we kind of get into our program here.
Okay.
The voice, of course, you're hearing. Can we play the Odetta piece? Just under us a little bit. Leah Gilmore's here co-hosting. She's the Center for Emerging Media's cultural editor, senior fellow for social justice at the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation. She was voted by Essence Magazine as one of 25 women shaping the world for global music activism and social justice, winner of the National Blues Music Award, which is the Grammys of our blues, for her historical research and support of women in the blues. And on June the 1st, I was there celebrating. She cut a live CD here at the Hubie Blake Center celebrating the music of classic blues women, which is the first time over 10 years she's recorded here in Baltimore, and also why we're doing this show today, from that show bringing it here.
Right. And with my Shiro.
And actually we're lucky and honored to have with us in studio Dr. Daphne Harrison, Professor Emerita from University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where she was the chair of the Africana Studies Department at UMBC, founder of the Drescher Center for Humanities at that same university, and author of the book, which will be part of our conversation today, Black Pearls, Black Queens, Black Queens of the 1920s.
Black Pearls Blues.
I looked at my sheet, which was written wrongly, incorrectly, I should say. Black Pearls Blues Queens of the 1920s.
Right.
And we're also joined by phone by Dr. Michelle Scott, Associate Professor of History at UMBC, where she is also an affiliate faculty member in Africana Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and Language and Literacy and Cultural Doctoral Program. And Dr. Michelle Scott, good to have you with us as well.
Hello, Dr. Scott.
Hello.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, or you can jump on our Facebook page. I'll see what you have to say there. Leah.
Yes.
Let me let you begin about why this program today we're hearing is important and what it meant to you to get this CD and let you get this rolling.
Well, if we are now moving to talking about blues women, why this is so important to me is that in the history of popular music, I think little is known by the populace how important women were to the development of not just only blues as a popular music, as a recorded music, but blues is the foundation of popular music, period, you know. And what's extremely exciting is that we get the opportunity. I wanted to celebrate that. And I hadn't recorded in the States in over 10 years. And I had never recorded in my own hometown in Baltimore City ever. And it was so, when I decided to do that, I decided to record the music of the classic blues women. And I was very, very much inspired by Dr. Harrison's scholarship. When I was doing research on women, these many years ago, and she is one of, I'm just excited to be in the same studio with her. I'm almost inarticulate, and to have Dr. Smith with us, who is an expert and wrote a book on Bessie Smith, correct, Dr. Smith?
Dr. Scott.
Dr. Scott. See, I'm making you Smith. There were so many Smith. Clara Smith, Bessie Smith, Mamie Smith. I'm making you a Smith, okay, the classic blues, period. But I would like to, you know, just jump off and starting with Dr. Harrison, whose book really is, along with Dr. Scott's, one of the definitive books on this period of time. What was it about this time? We know that blues is usually identified with men. I mean, W.C. Handy is called the father of the blues and is often associated in early times with itinerant blues travelers. What did these women do? This is a very broad question, to really change how we saw the blues. You can talk.
I'm sorry. I thought you were asking the question to her. I don't think that there was a plan to change it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to discuss what happened, what the development and of the music of African Americans. And I make that dash sign because I think that it has to be kept intact because so many people assume that after we passed the period of slavery and we got to the point where we had the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. that we don't have to think about those things in that way. However, if you read the newspaper, if you follow what is happening in our country, you know that we still have a cloud hanging over us.
Yeah.
And when I say over us, I don't mean us as a particular group. I mean our country, our nation.
Right.
That we have begun to, in some ways, taint new groups of people that have come to the United States since that period, who have had to scratch their way through their heritage and their culture to be accepted as not African American, but as Americans.
Right.
They may have Latino, Spanish, or Cuban, or other kinds of backgrounds, but somehow it seems that they all have to go through that test period where they are considered,
if you're brown.
Brown.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, Dr. Harrison, about that, just a little caveat that I heard today is that unemployment is definitely going down, but it's rising in our communities, in the black community. And so I think when you talk about that cloud still existing, not just perceptually, it is directly mm-hmm. still very much there. And it's difficult, I know, to get back to music, to talk about the beginning because so much of this was folk inspired, you know. But just a little bit about, very definitively, about Sophie Tucker, you know, not being able to make a recording session. You tell me how true this story is. And so they replaced her with Mamie Smith, and she recorded this thing called Loved, which was pivotal to the recording in 1920. Well, is this a true story? Sophie Tucker was a very famous white singer, and they did not want to record African Americans. They said nobody's going to buy the records. Yet when Mamie Smith was recorded, it was a huge hit. Can you tell us more about that?
But I'm not very clear on Sophie Tucker not being recorded.
She was supposedly ill, and she was supposed to sing this thing called Loved and Crazy Blues. And instead, because she couldn't sing it, and Dr. Scott, you can come in on it as well. You know, I'd love to hear your opinion. Because there's so much folklore around it, you know, that's how Mamie Smith got to record this thing called Love and Crazy Blues. Now, is that true or is it different? Or what is your take on it?
I think I'll have to pass that on to her because it's not something that has as a part of how I was looking at. I was looking at the women them particularly. And so not others who decided to try to do the music.
Right. Dr. Scott? Any thoughts on that?
Well, yes. Well, Sophie Tucker at the time was known as by the derogatory term of a coon shouter, which is derogatory to us now, but not at the time, which meant she was basically a white woman who could mimic the sounds of the black voice. And you were very right in saying that race records came into being, or black music on record. Recording industries did not want black women to record positive music. They thought their voice was too rough, too gut bucket, that would kind of be harsh on the ears for the mainstream listeners. So I'm not exactly sure if that particular Sophie Tucker story was true, because you have a host of women like Mamie Smith who are performing in places on vaudeville stages, tent shows, concert halls, but they're not being recorded.
Right,
so when you
exactly.
Have that moment that Smith is recording that thing called Love and You Can't Keep a Good Man Down in February of 1920, those records start to sell. And so when you have that connection between dollars and profit, all
right.
of a sudden that I...
It wasn't
that,
because
that
they all of a sudden had great altruism for the black women community.
Right. Right. So we love that gut bucket sound. It's selling.
Oh, yeah.
So let's do this. Let's jump into hearing a little bit of Mamie Smith for those who don't know who she is. And we're going to hear Crazy Blues. That's just a little taste of that before we hear a little taste of Ma Rainey in a second. But
Crazy Blues, it sold over 75,000 copies, and everyone was in shock. You know? They said, oh, my God, black people buy records.
So this was 1920.
This is money on leisure income, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So this was 1920.
Uh-huh.
And the 20s were a period after World War I when there were many severe violent attacks on returning black troops, and black towns were attacked in Oklahoma, the places, and burned to the ground. And this was a particularly virulent moment in terms of a surge of a black civil rights struggle in America.
The Harlem Renaissance.
So it was just beginning in the 1920s. And so what role did this music, the music of Mamie Smith, Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, play in that? I mean, how did that fit into the tenor of the moment?
I don't really think of it as playing into the tenor of the moment. I think of it as the continuation of music, because if we let's go back, maybe not a century from that particular period, but let's go back to just post Civil War era, and then you begin to realize that because of that point in history, you find that the acceptance of the white cultures, spiritual, that mm-hmm. is, religions, mm-hmm. and the confrontation with African practices, religious practices, begin to come together in unusual ways. And at the turn of the century, we find that people who have accepted the European Christian history studies, but also that slaves and slaves' children still maintained and retained the spiritual and musical aspects of their culture. And that's why we find that by the time we get to 1905,
mm-hmm.
no, I'll back up a little bit, 1895, and I'm getting back to my grandmother, okay?
Mine too.
Because my grandmother played piano for silent movies and things like that.
Oh,
and then you got Thomas Darcy. I'm talking about this Thomas Darcy, not that one. You get to Thomas Darcy.
Not Georgia Tom.
I'm talking about Georgia Tom.
Right.
When you get to him, he has been exposed to what began to happen with the war in Europe and our troops mm-hmm. coming back here prior to what was happening here. And then these soldiers coming back with the exposure to European music and European stages, mm-hmm. and they begin to show up in what they call coon shows at that time.
Right.
Okay. But that is also when new kinds of ways of introducing the same ideas, both the spiritual and the get down ones,
mm-hmm. same
begin to show up. And so that by the time 1930 comes, we have a curve where music goes away from the kind of usual very, very pretty and to downhearted blues, to Lord have mercy on upon us, and all of it's coming together in popular music and in religious music.
And that is
and that conjunction
right.
takes somebody like Tom, and
he did it.
Leaves his popular music and starts what becomes a different kind of spiritual music in the African
right.
continent.
He is truly the father of gospel music because that is such a good point, Dr. Harrison, and because he went from he had such a tragedy in his life when his wife died in childbirth, and later their son died. He said, I'm never going to sing popular music again. But what he didn't do is take away the blues. What he did was make the blues sacred and created gospel music.
What he did was take the music
uh-huh.
and put another text to it.
There you go.
Right.
There
Dr.
you go.
Scott, you want to jump in on right. this?
In terms of your first question or in terms of Thomas Dorsey?
The discussion we're having now.
Yeah.
Well, I think that Dorsey, or even that fusion, definitely takes all the blues music that he was performing when he was Georgia Tom. Things like, you know, It's Tight Like That and the rhythms. And
right,
the,
with Tampa
the
Red.
Body lyrics. And then has that personal transformation. And but doesn't, again, like you were saying, doesn't lose the beat, doesn't lose the rhythm. And that
Thomas
Dorsey. Now kind of becomes a way that particularly working class African Americans can express the feelings and the thoughts that they might not be able to discuss openly in terms of politics. Back to your earlier question of what's happening in that new Negro moment of the 1920s in the aftermath of World War One. So as gospel music is on the rise and blues music is on the rise, it's this other vehicle for working class African Americans to speak their truth to people who couldn't hear it otherwise.
Thomas Dorsey said, I've been put out of some of the best churches because of the way his music sounded. And now we think of that as the traditional gospel sound.
Right.
Getting back to the women of the blues.
Yes.
This is really one of my favorites, Gertrude Pritchett. And I'm sure your scholarship, who was known as Ma Rainey. and the mother of the blues. And I'm sure your book, Dr. Scott, probably goes into her, and I know you do, but yours does, Dr. Harrison. But she was really an important person to the blues. Can you talk a little bit, Dr. Scott, about Gertrude Ma Rainey and her contributions?
Well, Ma Rainey is kind of seen as like the pivotal link between what they call country blues or down-home blues and classic or vaudeville blues, is what Mamie Smith was, the more concert-based. She was performing in vaudeville shows with her husband, Mom Pa Rainey, in the early 1900s. She was one of the people who first heard the first strains of blues music as early as 1903. But she had that country sound, and they call her the same as they call W.C. Handy, the father of the blues. They call Ma Rainey the mother of the blues, particularly for the way that she was able to really move her listener with the songs, with her lyrics, and with her phrasing. And they were discussed in some of the research I've done that Ma Rainey was able to bring a crowd to tears just with without even saying the word, and singing songs that talked about the flood of 1927, for example. Just a moan or a murmur.
And oh, yeah. Well, that's big in our music. We got to moan sometime. You know what I think is really interesting, Dr. Harrison, with Ma Rainey, and one of her pivotal songs is C.C. Rider. And I get this question so much, and I would love to hear it from the expert. What does C.C. Rider mean?
Okay. I think that's pretty obvious.
Okay. Not too many. Not too many. You trying to find the right words?
I'm not trying to find the right word. I'm saying CC, right, see what you've done. Yeah. It means you've been chasing after me.
You made me love you.
And making me just yours, mm-hmm. and treating me any old way you want to. Okay. And most of the time, that's in a negative way.
Right.
And so... So the song is saying, see what you've done. In other words, you brought me down, not only physically, but emotionally.
Mm-hmm. But she's going to take care of it, because she's going to find her a good man, and she's not coming back till fall. That's what she said. And she's going to shoot that man.
Yeah, right. Well, that's why we have songs.
Yeah, that's why we have songs.
Sing about what we want to do because we can't do it.
I often think about it with the songs of this period. These women were so aggressive with what they were going to do. And it was kind of the antithesis of how the daintiness of what women should do. And, you know, when Bessie Smith sang, Judge, send me to the electric chair because I'm going to kill him. So you might as well just send me to the electric chair. There was a bit of feminism in there.
So we have to take a break here. We're going to come back. As we go out, we're going to listen to the C.C. Rider. Come right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner.
And it's Celia Gilmore.
Who co-hosts here at least every month.
Yeah.
And this is a very special one built on the concert and CD recording that Leah Gilmore did just on June the 1st, which was her interpretation of the great women of the blues and the history of our music that she sang. We're playing some of the women songs that she sang that night. We are joined here by Dr. Daphne Harrison, Professor Emerita, and former chair of Africana Studies at UMBC, where she was also the founder of the Dresser Center for Humanities, and author of the book Black Pearls, Blues Queens of the 1920s, and Dr. Michelle Scott, Associate Professor of History at UMBC, where she is also an affiliate faculty member in Africana Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and the Language, Literacy, and Cultural Doctoral Program. And both Dr. Scott and Dr. Harrison were part of a panel that we did at UMBC that we played, I was asked to be part of, that we played in the show a couple of weeks ago, that you heard all the stuff that was produced by Bobby Marvin Holmes.
And all here at UMBC, all the scholarship in Maryland.
We have tons of stuff.
Two of the most amazing women I'm telling you.
And by the way, folks, the number is 410-319-8888. Join us here with your thoughts. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. So Bessie Smith.
Bessie Smith, wow.
This is who we're listening to now.
Yeah, the Downhearted Blues, and Dr. Scott could talk so much more, more about it. More better. Let me say it like my grandmother. That's more better. She could do it. It's so great to be articulate and on the radio at the same time. I love it.
That's
why
we got you, baby.
Thank you.
Dr. Scott.
Dr. Scott, tell us about Downhearted Blues and a little bit about Bessie Smith. She was the goddess, that is called.
Well, Bessie Smith was known as the Empress.
Empress, yes.
Empress of the Blues. She was one of the highest paid black, you know, entertainers in the 1920s. She sold hundreds of thousands of records at a time when black women weren't really recording. She makes her first recording in 1923, so only 3 years after Mamie Smith. She crisscrosses the country in her own railroad car,
right.
Her and her whole cast, to prevent the fact that she doesn't want to ride in segregated railroads.
I love that story. I love that.
And she's just
buy my own car.
Yeah, she said, I'm just going to buy my own train.
Go ahead.
You're not going to make me sit in the back. Go buy my own train.
Own train. Bessie Smith was she just has a really powerful voice, particularly at a time during record where she could, you know, you're not really being amplified when you're singing on stage in the same way that you are now, and she could just stand on stage and belt it out. The song that you're playing right now, Downhearted Blues, actually written by Alberta Hunter,
right.
Lovey Austin. So actually two other Tennessee blues women, so Bessie Smith from Chattanooga, so she's kind of joining her Tennessee crew there. But she, and of course I'm biased because I write on Bessie Smith, but I thought she really perfected the delivery of talking about
women's okay, trials. We okay with that bias.
I'm very biased. You know? Women's trials, concerns about love, unrequited love, but also about social issues like poverty, like war. Her lyrics kind of span the gamut on social concerns that plagued African Americans at the time.
And that was pretty brave to do. Do you not think, Dr. Scott, that this is something that was not expected of women songwriters during this time period?
She was very brave to do so, particularly not just in mainstream culture, but also within the African-American community. Mm-hmm. We were talking about earlier that a lot of these blues women were speaking about feminist, or what we call feminist issues now, what they wouldn't necessarily deem at the time. But they were on the margins of society in African-American communities. They were independent. They weren't necessarily married or didn't necessarily have children. They spoke their minds. And they were in that, you know, form of life that wasn't necessarily the upright, moral, Christian way to go,
right.
At a time when African-Americans were trying to present their most respectable side. And so the blues women were kind of going against that grain, but saying, look, these are the issues that hurt women every day. You know, poverty, hunger, the need for love, unrequited love, people cheating on them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were that voice for people who might not, you know, have that conversation with that average woman. They could hear it in Bessie's songs or hear it in Alberta Hunter's.
Okay, go ahead, Mark.
I was just curious, when we talk about like people like Bessie Smith and Alberta Hunter and the rest, you know, I've recently been thinking a lot about American history, and there's so many pieces of our history that got lost in terms of the importance and how they molded society, molded culture, molded music. And in some ways, this is now your work, Dr. Scott, and the work you've always done, Dr. Harrison, as well. I mean, this is kind of opening up a door to this profound influence on American society that we didn't know before. We didn't allow ourselves to know before.
Well, many didn't know before. You know, that the importance of women. I remember just doing research on blues, and the reason why I got so interested in about women in the blues is because there was so little written about women in the blues. I mean, there was a lot about, you know, Son House and the Itinerant Players and
right.
Robert Johnson and so many. But when I stumbled upon Dr. Harrison's book, and a book called Wild Women Don't Sing the Blues, which was a song written by Ida Cox.
Ida Cox will be hearing in a minute. Great songwriter
who was ahead of her time in publishing and all other things.
So what do you think about that, Dr. Harrison? I'll start with you and go to Dr. Mm-hmm. Scott. I mean, just your thought on the influence these women had that I think is fairly profound that we're just beginning to recognize.
Well, kind of to echo what Dr. Harrison was saying earlier, that just these blues songs, but also the spirituals, the work songs, the field hollers,
right,
the tree before, that were really the foundation of American popular music.
That's right.
If you think about the blues music that's being sung in the 20s and 30s, and then following the men and the women who are moving during the Great Migration to places like Chicago or Detroit or New York, and then those blues songs become R&B songs, which become the mainstay of 1940s, 50s, mm-hmm. Popular music, I mean, whether the listeners know that or not. And then even bringing it up to today, if I always have these debates with my students about they discuss the popularity of hip-hop music today, and I'm like, the lyrics that they're discussing now have nothing on what people like Lucille Bogan were talking about.
There you
go.
Shave them dry.
That's just an old trajectory. Right. We're not inventing anything. We're just building on centuries of African Americans.
What a great point.
Dr. Harrison?
Well, I think that we have to... The two things affected the music in the century from 1900 to now. One of them was the change in where African Americans were and what they're able to do and not able to do. The impact of African soldiers, African American soldiers who returned after World War I had a great deal of impact on what occurred in the African-American community because they came back strong, proud, right, having been exposed to cultures that they probably, in most instances, had never heard of.
And were treated
and some
like
of them
men.
remained in Europe until, say, almost time for the Second World War before they came back. Some of them remained there and made their own marks, taking the culture of African-American music and history and melding it with the European, particularly in places like Paris those large cities in Europe that were where African-American soldiers, some remained and didn't come back home just when it was
right.
over.
World
and
War
they
II
brought
also.
With them, by the time World War II came in, they had already brought back some experiences and some understanding and some additional musical
nuances.
Yes. And so those things you can see if you look at how the music changed around 1950.
Mm-hmm.
We've got things have just really begun to change because now, well, technology has a lot to do with it. Now, more African Americans are hearing different kinds of music from themselves as mm-hmm. a result of the
exactly.
exposure that those people who did go right. and come back brought back something that made a difference in how we think about not only the lyrics, but the style of the music.
I think you are so on point with that. As I travel the world, and I was just in Siberia of all places, mm-hmm. and I know the black girl in Siberia because that's what it was. But Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey are known entities in Siberia, and they are revered. You know, I think sometimes when our music is too close to us, we don't really understand the impact that our music has had on the world. But as we go around the world, black American, African American music is so profoundly important around the world that when you turn on the radio, that's what you hear often. And you hear our historical music and you hear our contemporaneous music. And Dr. Scott, I think you made such a point. Hip hop did not invent, you know, interesting lyrics. You know, when I think about, like you said, like Lovie Austin, and I think about Handyman, and I think about Ida Cox and her 4-Day Creep, We definitely have said many things, but what they used was a double entendre a lot of times.
Exactly.
You know, and the double entendre is very important in the development of these classic blues.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just so amazing, you know, when you hear, what are we listening to now?
It's a little early, but it's Ida Cox, Wild Women Don't Get the Blues.
Right. She said, I never want to treat one man right. I leave him wanting both day and night. She said, wild women don't worry. Wild women don't get the blues, okay? And that was something profound to say in the 1920s. Dr. Harrison?
Well, I think that we also have to recognize that technology has begun to change.
Right.
And so more people were being exposed to a greater amount of different kinds of music, particularly between World War I and World War II. And then by the time our troops came home in World War II, then we have another.
Oh, yeah. Whole nother. That's right.
We get not only what they carried, because what they carried over there, our soldiers, both African American and Italian and whoever else that went to fight for the United States. They also experienced things, say in Paris, that were rather interesting compared to those African American soldiers who were in Paris at the end of the First World War.
Right.
Okay. That's because right. Some of them remained in Paris, and they were there when the soldiers went in for World War II. And so you have a rewrapping of what was going on, but then an opening up because the technology makes it possible to hear it whether you get there or not.
That is so true. And the technology now has done the same thing. I mean, it has opened it up even more. We are a push button away from whatever we want. Just look at YouTube. You know, go find it. You can. I've got something to ask Dr. Scott. When we talk about Alberta Hunter, first we were just listening to Ida Cox, and she was really.
What would you like to cue up for Alberta Hunter?
For Alberta Hunter, let's listen to a little bit of Rough and Ready Man.
We'll cue up Rough and Ready Man, okay. Alberta Hunter. But go ahead, Dr.
But yes, you can call me Dr. Gilmore. No, it's not true. But you can say it.
Would you like me to say it?
You know, I think these two women worked very hard to get that doctor. Okay. But with Alberta Hunter, there was also Dr. Harrison and Dr. Scott. There was a regional difference that was starting to happen, and even in the 1920s with the blues, with blues women. There were the Southern gut bucket singers, you know, that we associate Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey with. But then there was Ethel Waters, who was born in Pennsylvania, and, you know, and Alberta Hunter, who moved up north. And there was a sophistication thought of that was associated with those singers who sang in the North with the blues and a vaudevillian factor to it, you know. And then there were the gut bucket Southern singers. Was there conflict there, or was this just a derivation of our music?
See, I have problems with that term.
Which term?
Gut bucket.
Okay.
Yeah. Tell me about it. Yeah.
I have problems with it. I mean, I know it's. I mean, it's a part of the vernacular when they're just making the discussions. But what I saw and heard and when I was doing research in that area was people who are singing about their experience there, and if you were in Mississippi, some parts of Louisiana, and up and around in that area, then you understood when it was okay to sing about certain things and talk about certain things in certain places. As long as you were in church or shouting and carrying on, that was fine.
Right, that's right.
But don't be caught by certain people.
Right.
Enjoying this kind of music. Well, that goes back to prior to 1900. The same thing occurred when we had, if I'm jumping you back more than 200 years.
Okay.
When we're talking about people getting off those ships who happened to survive that that trip from Europe, okay, and when we talk about people who decide that because they're very bright and they're intelligent, and a lot of people don't think about us that way.
Yeah.
But they were intelligent enough to understand, okay, I have some kind of God, but this is the God I'm going to have to make my God in order to survive, not only physically, but intellectually, and both in terms of my own feelings about myself. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you find slavery was awful. But also the fact that we are putting people into a new kind of setting. And the same thing has happened with the way religion has changed the music and who sings the music.
Mm.
So when you had Dorsey decide he was going to be not a gut bucket player and having a good time anymore, begins to write his religious songs and brought a total change to what religious music was in the African American community.
Right. And we always have those moments with Alberta Hunter, Dr. Scott. Thank you so much, Dr. Harrison.
That was amazing.
It really is.
We can do a whole show just about that.
Oh, yeah. And we should do a whole show just about that change. You know, it's amazing. He changed our music. Dr. Scott, I love Alberta Hunter and Dr. Harrison. But she sang a song, You Can't Tell the Difference After Dark.
Yes.
And this was a very powerful song, basically about race. Straight up. She says, she was talking about, why don't you basically treat me like a woman, a beautiful woman, because I'm black? You know, I think this was a very profound political statement. What do you think the importance of that was?
Let's hear a piece so people know what we're talking
about.
Let's cue this up and just listen to it just for a minute of it so people can get a sense of what the lyrics you're talking about.
And then we'll come back
to Dr. Scott.
Look what the sun has done to me. It seems there's no more fun to me. Why must all the boys act so shy? I have guessed the reason why. I may be as brown as a berry, but that's only secondary, and you can't tell a difference after dark. I may not be so appealing, but I've got that certain feeling, and you can't tell a difference after dark. They say that gentlemen prefer the blonde-haired ladies. Tell me, am I out of style?
I may be brown as a berry, but I'm not secondary. You can't tell the difference after dark. Okay? They say that gentlemen prefer the blonde-haired ladies. don't dislike me because I'm a little shady. I think that's something amazing to say, you know, given the race relations during that time period and the de facto and the de jure segregation that was going on during that time period. Dr. Scott, what do you think about this song? I mean, what do you think? I mean, they were not just singing about my man that left me, which usually, you know, was still great. Not great thing, but great song. But what do you think about the political implications of some of these songs these women were singing?
Well, actually, songs like You Can't Tell the Difference After Dark and other songs like What Can I Do? What Did I Do to Be So Black? And
Blue, yeah, I love that one.
Are coming from like off-Broadway black musicals in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And they're really talking about color consciousness, at least when they're written for the musical, within the black community. The difference between dark skin, preference for dark skin, preference for light skin, straight hair, curly hair.
Mm-hmm.
And at that same moment that there is an attempt to try to have this unifying new Negro image or political and social movement towards change, there's this discussion of this infighting over color preferences, hair preferences, class preferences. And what country is really doing, if you're taking that song off of the stage and putting it into, like, popular homes, is talking about kind of like personal business within the African-American community and bringing it up to a wider audience.
Right.
Saying that color consciousness is definitely still there, and it leads to a broader conversation about why are people so color consciousness, or why is there a color difference, you know, looking at the legacy of slavery. So it's very profound and very political at a moment when people were thinking, oh, I'm just going to listen to the happy, you know, blues music and dance. It's not just about dancing. It's very much making a political statement.
Right. And it's interesting because the music sounds so happy, but she's making a heck of a statement while she's singing it, you know. And Alberta Hunter made a later resurgence in her life, you know, which I always thought was great. She lied about her age when she was young to get, you know, to start singing. I think she was 14, Dr. Harrison, I don't know.
Something like that.
Yeah. Then she lied about her age to come back, to become a nurse. She said she was younger. And then when she came back, you know, I missed a lot of this in the 80s. She became a star again up in the New York scene, cabaret scene. And one of her biggest songs was Handyman. Mm-hmm. So we should listen to a little bit of Handyman.
Do we have that on our list yet?
Yeah.
Oh, that's your last song.
Yeah.
Handyman.
Right.
Alberta Hunter.
I can talk the lyrics now. It'd be a little bit more profound if I talk the lyrics.
So what, yeah, my handyman ain't so handy no more.
There you go. He shakes my ashes. He greases my griddle. He churns my butter and he strokes my fiddle. My man is such a handy man. We ready?
Positively, absolutely sure was blind. Because I just found the best man that ever was. And here's just a few of the things that he does. Ow. He shakes my ashes, greases my griddle, churns my butter, and he strokes my fiddle. Oh, my man is such a handy man. Threads my needle and he creams my wheat, heats my heater, and he chops my meat. He's a mess. My man is such a handy man. Now I don't care if you believe it or not. He's a mighty nice
man. All right,
so,
now.
I have to ask this question. It'll be about 4 minutes left. This is important. I think that I'm watching Across the Glass. We have all these incredible young interns working here at the Mark Steiner Show from UMBC and Morgan State University.
They're incredible, really.
And they're listening to this music, Dr. Harrison. And what is the importance of this, what we're doing today, and this music, and the roots of all this for us, for this generation watching us across the glass?
Oh,
I know. Who else can I ask but you?
But we don't have time.
give us the short version. We'll do the long version next time.
Right. The short version is that technology has made it possible to get to touch so many different things that the technology is what captures the young people, not what's coming out of it. Okay. It's what, how you can do, I wonder if I can do this, I wonder if I can, really, and I'm operating from my own experiences as a faculty member. And if you want to see desperation, you walk into a classroom like Daphne Harrison, and she's telling you what we're, this is the lecture, back and forth, and then here's this crazy woman, comes in one morning, she has a basket.
Oh, no, you don't.
Yes,
all right,
she did.
All right, now.
And when she comes in, hello, and now we're going to then have our little welcome song, which we all love to do.
Oh, I love
and
that.
And then I had another terrible thing that I did. I didn't let people sit in a row.
Oh.
I made a sort of semicircle so that we had maybe sometimes two rows. But it was like, if you start at this door and go all the way around and come to that, practically that door. That's how my classroom was.
Right.
And I did that because I wanted them to see each other.
That's right.
Hear each other. And then I told them, now that you know, I'm the most important person in this room.
Okay.
And then when they got to the point where they found out, oh, texting back and forth to each other, what did that woman do? She had a basket.
Oh, did she take them?
Yes, I did.
There you go now.
You had to learn how to listen and
write. Well, you just
gave
me an idea for the next class I taught.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's so easy to be enamored of the technology that you don't pay attention to the substance.
But you know what's interesting? I was also watching these young people, and they are young people. They were listening to the words of Handy Man and listening to the music, and I saw their faces. And they were like, what? Are they saying that now? Dr. Scott, do you get that?
In 2 minutes.
I do. I've managed to embarrass many a classroom by playing Kitchen Man or any other song. But I think the music, it brings up to date the fact that they're thinking that everything that they're doing, thinking, writing, texting, et cetera, is something that they're inventing themselves. And I think by playing music in lectures, whether it's blues music or R&B, kind of makes the history that you're talking about much more present, that this is not a dead art form, a dead subject, that we're still living what's going on in these songs, whether it's sexual double entendre or the political commentary, that it's still very much alive.
So we have to come back to this, and I have some thoughts about how to do this show in several different parts with our guests here today and more.
I think that's a great idea.
I want to thank Dr. Michelle Scott from UMBC, Associate Professor of History. Michelle, it's always great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Dr. Daphne Harrison, whose book Black Pearls, Blues Queens in the 1920s, is a classic. She's former chair of Africana Studies at UMBC and founder of the Drescher Center for Humanities. Dr. Harrison, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I love you.
And then maybe we can do something where we will have some young people to just find out how they feel about this music and why.
That's where I'm thinking, too.
Yeah.
And Leah Gilmer, thank you for co-hosting once again.
It's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
And our way out the door into our next topic, I want to remind you all that the Filling Station has provided breakfast for our guests this morning. That you can find the Filling Station on the web, Filling Station Coffee Shop on York Road in Sparks, Maryland, open from 6:30 to 5 p.m. Tacos, burritos, homemade soups, and more. And I want to remind you to come out this weekend, 9 to noon, at the corner of Hereford Road and York Road out in the country, for a farmer's market that is one of the best around. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Don't go away.
Bye-bye.
And he creams my wheat, heats my heater, and he chops my meat. He's a mess, my man. He's such a handyman.